Welcome to the Speak As Well As You Think podcast, brought to you by Vautier Communications. I'm your host, Jen Alex, and the goal of this show is to uncover communication strategies and behaviors that you can use to improve the way that you show up and perform at work. We'll talk about what effective communication looks like in action so that you can apply it to your own career. If you'd like a written summary of each episode, subscribe to our weekly email newsletter by visiting vautiercommunications.com. Welcome back to the Speak As Well As You Think podcast. Today, we are going to talk about cross-cultural communication, specifically when it comes to language barriers. You'll hear a lot of different terms out there to describe English as a language. You might hear EAL, which is English as an additional language, ESL, English as a second language, EFL, English as a first language. All of these things are pretty similar in terms of what they mean, but we're talking about groups that have multiple languages they might know, or a group that maybe is primarily English speaking only. And this is important because when we think about business today, business is really done in the English language. That is the language of business overall. And so it's important that we understand how to communicate with a group where English is not their primary language, and or as somebody that speaks multiple languages, how do you communicate with a group where English is their primary and or only language? So we're going to break that up into two different categories. The first one, let's talk about those of us who are native English speakers and what things we can think about when it comes to communicating with a group that does not speak English primarily. And Matt, let's go to you first.
Yeah. And Jen, I like that first piece that you touched upon where you said that business is conducted mainly in English these days, which that's very true. What I seen the stat is, I believe it's 1.75 billion people read or write English or speak English at what they would call a useful level. The thing about this metric that I want to point out is that this does not mean it's at a fluent level. This does not mean they're getting all of the subtle nuances and all of those little things that an English first language speaker will pick up. I think that's one of the large things to keep into account as an English speaker when dealing with maybe some of these other international or other cultural groups that we interact with. There's thousands of languages, thousands of dialects that come across the world, and we know that even though they may speak English in a very formal capacity within business in their day-to-day roles, it doesn't mean they're catching all of those little things that we may have picked up in 20, 30, 40, 50 years speaking that language in a person-to-person or interpersonal area.
Yeah.
One of these big things is I know from Connecticut being how we are with the English language. We have that yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, yes. This is one of those areas within business where even subtle pieces like that, as we're going to break into, are a big cause of complication, a big cause of confusion, and places we do really need to look at avoiding where we may misstep in terms of that verbiage.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. The yeah, no, no, yeah. That always makes me laugh when you think about it, because as a native English speaker, we understand that. I think some of the other things to think about that piggyback off of that are the idioms that we use, those analogies, any other of that jargon we might have. You know, if somebody gets up and says, well, way to throw me under the bus. Well, somebody who's not a native English speaker might say, wait, who was thrown under the bus? And
are they okay?
It doesn't hit, right. It doesn't hit the same way. Or if you ask for a ballpark figure, some of us who have grown up learning and knowing English as our primary language, we might not even know where ballpark figure comes from. But we understand what it means. If you did not grow up in an English speaking, and maybe that's even more of an American English speaking, not just English speaking in general, but some of those sayings and idioms, you have to understand, does my audience know what this means? And if they don't, is it going to add more confusion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it a lot of the discussion dials back to knowing your audience. Yeah. And as a speaker running a meeting with an audience that might not all have English as their native language, probably more appropriate to err on the side of explaining certain analogies, using maybe less idioms, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But this even goes, as we've had experience working with people just across the states in different parts of our country, in different parts of the United States of America, you might hear things in the South that you wouldn't necessarily hear in the Northwest, or Matt might hear things in the Northeast that you would use out in California, and people would draw a blank stare and wonder, I don't understand, I don't track, I don't follow.
Yep.
So a lot of it does tie back to knowing who your audience is. I do think in most cases, people are aware of those changes. And I think from an audience's perspective, the appreciation really happens when pace slows down, when volume increases to a level which can be easily understood. Because if the audience needs to continue leaning in and try to literally hear what's being shared, it doesn't matter what the idioms, it doesn't matter what the analogies, it doesn't matter what jargon is being used, they can't hear it, period. But as it's my experience with audiences that might not have English as their first language, managing the pace, making sure that vocal clarity and the enunciation is there so that words that don't necessarily flow fluidly can stand on their own and not run together. And as I work with people who have a different first language, they might tell me, John, I use phrases that all run together. Mm-hmm. And there are three or four. My audience in my country understands it point blank. But as I move to a different type of audience, that's when I have to start to really dig into, okay, what's going to make the most sense, or where is the most benefit going to exist given my rate of speech?
Yeah. And I think that's a great point on the speaking slower. Now, when we talk about speaking slower, we're not talking about speaking to somebody as if they're basic or uneducated. You don't want to come across as if you are telling that audience that they're dumb. It's speaking at an even medium and a clear pace. So as an example, I'm currently learning Spanish, and I find that I read it so much more effectively than when I'm listening to it, because the listeners on the app that I'm using speak quickly. And there's an option, there's a little turtle, so I can slow it down and hear it at an easier pace as I'm learning. But I do find that when I can read the text that's in front of me in Spanish, I comprehend it so much easier when it's being spoken to me. If the pace is too quick, I'm picking out words to try and make context of what's being shared. And then I miss two sentences after that. And so again, the slow pace, it's not slow and dumb. It's slow and measured so that it's easier for that audience to follow along.
Yeah. And I tend to define the slower pace rather than focusing on slowing down a pace, adding in more pauses,
mm-hmm.
taking more breaks where there is a very distinct start and stop. And that stop allows me to take a breath. I can view my audience. If they're in person, it's great, because as we've talked about in previous episodes, our audience does quite a bit of communicating with us. They do so non-verbally.
Right.
We can gauge an audience. We can look out at that audience and say, okay, did they track with what I just shared? Or am I still getting blank stares? Am I seeing some nods and maybe in disagreement or confusion, where again, I can make course corrections in the moment? We can't do that when we're going a mile a minute. So it's really more about, can you add in purposeful pauses? And we've talked at length in various episodes about the power of the pause. But I don't want people listening to think, okay, I've got to get out a words per minute type of piece to figure mm-hmm. out my pacing and then really decrease that. It's not as scientific as that. It's figuring out, where can I implement more pauses on purpose so that there's space for people to absorb, consume, make sense of what I've shared.
Exactly. And John, I think those are two of the biggest pieces that you've been talking about consistently, but I think we've kind of hopped over that main theme as to why the articulation and the complexity, making sure that, one, we're being as articulate as possible, utilizing those pauses, making sure that our cadence is good, and also the complexity, making sure we're using words that mm-hmm. if we were to hear them for the first time, we would probably be able to decipher what they meant if we hadn't heard them already. I think the big piece for us is a lot of these people who are speaking English as a second language are mentally translating this information as they're hearing it, whether it's them reading it and then moving along and saying, okay, let me see what this is in my language, and then coming back, or vice versa, when they are hearing it, doing that quick mental translation and then spitting out whatever they think in that English. But again, we want to give our participants enough time to do that. We don't want to overwhelm them. We don't want to take away their ability to translate, because at the end of the day, their ability to translate, connect the dots is going to equal their ability to retain that information from the session. If we don't give them that chance to translate, odds are they're going to be drinking from that fire hose and they're going to be stuck there saying, I know that I know English, but in general, that was just a little bit too much, a little bit too fast for me, as a lot of us would if we were listening to a second language that was not English.
Yeah. This comment came up in a program I ran 2 weeks ago. Not a native English speaker. She had beautiful English, but it was not her first language.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, John, what are the advantages of having content, i.e. slides, PDF, some type of visuals, in addition to something hard copy? And I found the question excellent, because adult learners learn across three levels: auditory, visual, and then kinesthetic. Some mm-hmm. adult learners will learn by listening. Some adult learners will learn by seeing or reading, and then other adult learners will learn by doing something actively. The kinesthetic would be taking notes, highlighting something in hard copy if they received it in hard copy. If we can tap into all three of those, especially as our world gets bigger and bigger, and I say bigger and bigger, cross-cultural communication, right? It's constant that we interact with others who come from different walks of life culturally. Giving them the ability to see things, hear things, mm-hmm. and then be able to jot down notes, highlight, circle, whatever kinesthetic feature they would connect to, that really captures all three levels of learning. And I do think, and I shared with her, that that's going to give you more times than not a better outcome in allowing your audience to track with the message. But if you're only operating on, I prepared a talk today, but I don't have any visuals and I've got nothing to share with you hard copy, you're capping yourself in the ability to capture the audience that would learn best by seeing or by doing. And if all they can do is hear, they might not hear as quickly as others, just given the language differences.
Yeah. And actually, I think that's a great example of, and it doesn't matter what side you're on, if you're a native English speaker or English is not your primary language, no matter what side, if you're communicating to a group that speaks a different primary language than you, having those graphics or infographics can be super helpful, because that is the universal language, is seeing something. So if you think about traveling abroad, no matter, again, where abroad is for you, you go to a different country, you might not know that language. If you are asking for help, if you're asking for directions, people are using their hands. They're trying to mimic what it is they're trying to say. If you think about any road or transportation signs in different countries, most often they're visual, not a word on a sign, but it shows a picture of a train, and that's where you know where the train station is, or it shows a picture of the bus. Having those graphics there can be super helpful in filling in any of the other little pieces that perhaps I missed in terms of what you're saying and the comprehension, that can help give me the greater context of whatever the point you're trying to make is.
Yeah, it's the subtitles experience when we're watching TV shows or movies. If we can't keep up with the language or the accent is very heavy, the experience is heightened significantly in a positive way when we have access to the subtitles.
Yep.
And you can watch the exact same film or the exact same TV series, one with subtitles on, another with subtitles off, and have two wildly different experiences or outcomes based on saying, oh my God, I love that film, or that's one of my favorite shows, or I couldn't keep up with it. I couldn't make sense of it. It did nothing for me. All product of being able to see the text or see the message being shared.
I think this leads me into a little bit more of a question for you two, as I know you're a bit more grounded in this realm and have had a little bit more experience in this realm than I have. With any listeners listening out there that are English speaking and they find themselves in rooms with a lot of people who are ESL or EAL, whatever that may be, what are some tips and tricks that you would give to them, or what would be your number one tip or trick to give to them in order to get through that to that audience, one, or two, in order to find a maybe secondary form of communication or avenue that's going to be viable for them in that business setting?
I have two off the top of my head. First, my recommendation is always to use simple language. And when I say simple, think universal, not dumb. So again, we're not trying to talk to an audience as if they don't have the educational level to understand us. But if I think about a really easy example, I could use the word think, or I could use the word contemplate. they both mean the exact same thing. Most everybody understands what the word think means. A good chunk of people might not know what contemplate means. And then all of a sudden they're losing the understanding of what I'm trying, the point I'm trying to make. So when you have the option, why not go with the simpler option? That's always step number one. Step two, I think you also have to be conscious of if somebody asks you to repeat what you've said more than two times, don't keep saying the same thing and saying it louder. Chances are at that point, it's not that they didn't hear you. It's that they don't understand what you're saying. And so thinking about, okay, how can I say this in a different way? And again, that might come back to being simpler with the language that I'm using, or somehow creating an easier 10,000 foot view of saying something that might resonate better, but.
And clarifying that. Let me try explaining it this way, or let me share it through this lens.
Yeah.
But this way they realize, okay, Jen or John is trying over in a different lane this time to see if it makes more sense.
Right, right. It's not just saying the same thing over and over and it little by little getting louder with the volume and hoping that maybe if I shout it at you, you'll get it this time. That typically doesn't work and it can come across as insulting.
Yeah,
and
then I heard actually, you the first three times, I still don't understand it.
Exactly. And then I'll add a third in here on telling an audience before you start, I'm going to take these pulse checks. I'm going to stop and ask for questions often throughout. I would like you all to cut me off if you have a question or if something I said didn't resonate or make sense, because I would rather make sure that we, and that's how I actually start most of my programs, no matter where I work, because again, something I'm talking about might not be front of mind or at a level of understanding of other people. And so questions pop up all the time. But I think it's especially important when you are talking to a group that has a different language than you, letting them know that I'm happy to take questions anytime you have them. And then as the speaker, building in those multiple pulse checks, you know, I go through three or four or five slides, a section of a talk, and then I give a good, does anybody have any questions? Is there anything else I can go back over? However you want to word it, but allowing people to say, you know what? I am a little bit confused here. Could you explain X, Y, or Z?
Yeah. And I was going to say, my big one is the pulse checks. It's really partitioning or bracketing out your content, because you're going to know it better than anybody else. And so as you know where you're going to start to move gears, shift lanes, that's where you make a conscious effort to say, before I move on, what questions do we have on this section? I know we covered a lot in the last 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Let that silence sit, because what you're hoping your audience is going to do is start to think back, or maybe they look at their notes and they say, okay, yeah, John, I had a question on slide number 7, or I had a question a couple minutes ago, you were talking about project implementation timeline. Can we go back to that slide real quick? Or can you go back to that section and talk me through when exactly this is going to start to roll out? But if you don't give that opportunity, and that's where I like to frame it open-ended. I do find, from my experience, open-ended, what questions do you have before I move on versus do you have any questions?
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference in how that's received by the audience. And in my experience, when I frame it, do you have any questions? It's not uncommon for me to hear crickets or silence, or I get a nod of the head, no, which is okay if you don't want to feel any questions. But if you are expecting, or you think, I know that was a long section, I know I have an audience here that may not follow everything as quickly as I'm taking them through it, I want to make sure they have an opportunity to engage or interact. Frame it open-ended, because it's a little nicer invitation for them to say, all right, I'm not going to feel out of bounds here by asking a question. It sounds like John's expecting questions to come his way or her way.
And then one of the other things that I was just thinking about as John was talking here, when it comes to being a native English speaker, I've heard this in a couple of settings, and I think it can come across the wrong way. Be cautious of correcting somebody if they haven't asked for it or in a public setting. So for instance, let's say somebody has the wrong emphasis on a word, and so it's not sounding the same way. I always use the example in, my sister and I were watching the British Bake Off once, and the bakers kept saying oregano. And we were like, I can't, man, that's familiar, but I don't know what oregano is. And then we realized that it was oregano, but the way they say it is just a different emphasis than us. So rather than in that moment stopping that person and saying something like, Oh, you mean oregano. That's how you say that word in a public setting, which can come across somewhat insulting, intimidating. As soon as you grab the context, go with it. If that person has asked for feedback, that's a great thing afterwards to be able to say the pronunciation of this word in our language is X, Y, and Z, and that can help them start to learn some of those nuances. But the more you correct somebody in a public setting in the moment, typically the more anxiety that brings around speaking English in our case here to an audience that is a native English speaking audience, it creates more stress and anxiety for that non-native English speaking presenter. And that can make it harder for them to get up the next time and try and do it again.
And that's my big takeaway from what both of you have said there is be conducive and make sure that you're being open. Remember, it's a skill or a trait or something of that sort that they're learning for the first time. We need to make them want to continue to dive in and learn more and play around with that English language a little bit more. And the more corrections, the less clarity, the more they feel like this is something that is blunt and brutal and right in front of them that they can't change, the less likely they are to want to experiment with that English language, catch some of those subtle nuances, and actually learn more. It's the same thing where if I'm going out to play golf, the last thing I want to do when I'm starting to play golf is go out to the hardest rated course in all of Connecticut and start playing. Again, I'm going to start somewhere a little bit easier where there's people that aren't going to get mad at how slow I'm playing or where I'm hitting the ball because they understand that. It's very much the same thing in business. We know if we have personnel that are newer to our workforce and just starting to learn English, are new to the country and are just starting to learn English, we need to give those people a little bit of extra time because, in general, that's going to change their view of English as a whole, English speakers as a whole, and the way that they use that within business.
Yeah. And I think more organizations are adapting either groups or opportunities internally, giving opportunities to attend something externally where it's a safe environment for speakers who don't necessarily have English as their first language, or vice versa. You look at other cross-cultural companies where you take on a new role and you're doing a whole lot over in Germany. You're doing a whole lot over in Asia Pacific region. Opportunities for English speakers to immerse themselves in that culture and say it feel safe about asking questions to Jen's point, feel safe about saying, am I saying this word correctly here? It's not needing to be overcorrected, but it's making sure I want to make sure I'm meeting my audience where they are. So if I'm using a phrase that either doesn't make sense to them or the emphasis is on the wrong syllable, then all of a sudden I need someone to tell me that because I don't know what I don't know.
Right. And I think that if we transition to, I mentioned we'd break this up into two buckets here. So the first, if you are a native English speaker, if we flip it to the other side, you're not a native English speaker and you are going to be speaking to a group that does have English as their primary language. John, I think as you mentioned, it's looking for those opportunities to speak in English as often as you can and then ask for feedback. Be open to receiving it, especially in more of those laid back team meetings, casual situations where there's not a lot of pressure. I would ask at the end of that interaction, did I say anything that was incorrect in terms of how you all would say it on a day-to-day basis? And then one of the other things that my sister's always recommended too, she said, put on like a soap opera, a Spanish soap opera, and just have it in the background and listen to it. The more you start to hear those things, the more you're picking up on it. And so it's learning by osmosis, but you start to see and hear and get all of those components together there.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big pieces is we can't get down on ourselves. It's very much the same thing as if you are an English first language speaker and you're learning another language, very much with you, Jen, learning Spanish. The number one thing that you do is you pick it up every day, whether it's one question or more, you know that you're continuing to work on that no matter how good or poor that day before was. No matter who you interacted with that day before and how that went, I want all of our people out there right now that are learning English for the first time, are deep diving further into their English. Just remember, if whoever you are working with has any sort of wherewithal and is any sort of a good business partner, they will take that time. They will have that understanding with you. So please don't feel like you are inhibiting the way that that business is going, the way that that lesson is going, or the way that that conversation is going. Because again, everybody around you is very aware that you are taking that conscious effort to try to grow your skills. And that is much more highly appreciated than someone who is stuck in those ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And then I would say one of the other things, if you are a non-English speaking as your primary language, I would typically coach you to speak louder. I would not always coach, especially American English people, to always speak louder depending on their level to other cultures, because culturally, American English tends to be very loud speakers compared to other parts of the world. But coming from other parts of the world into especially American English, we are used to hearing things at a louder volume. And so if you also have an accent, or if you are still learning the language, and as John mentioned earlier, you might start speaking at a three, it's going to be harder to understand what you're saying. So typically other cultures coming into speaking, again, I'll say American English because that's what I'm familiar with being an American English speaker, but probably other parts of the world that also have English as a primary language, we just tend to speak louder. And so for those English as an additional language folks, speaking up is not going to be seen as yelling or hollering. Again, John and I have worked with maybe three people ever that we've said, time out, you're too loud. You got to bring it down a little bit, or people will think you're yelling at them, or you're too overbearing. Almost everybody else, we're pushing to speak at a louder volume that's clear and easy for everybody to hear. All right. So this was a really fun topic. And I think it's one that we might come back to later in the year and piggyback back off of for another episode. But again, for our listeners, when you're thinking about speaking to a group that does not have the same primary language as you, a couple of those key reminders, again, slow your pace down. Use that simple universal language for everyone to understand. And then I think the other piece, find the universal language in things like graphics, infographics, visuals, using your nonverbal skills like gestures and maybe perhaps body movement can be really helpful in filling in the gaps that a language barrier might produce. But we do all have that same nonverbal universal communication style as well. As always, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next month. Thanks for listening to the Speak As Well As You Think podcast, brought to you by Vautier Communications. Again, I am your host, Jen Alex. Vautier Communications is in the business of business communication skills. We coach and train both individuals and groups on how to elevate their presence and increase their impact through the way they communicate, present, and write. If you want to learn more about our in-person or virtual training options, visit our website at www.vautiercommunications.com. Thanks for listening.